This is One-on-One with Mark Monty on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. And Dr. Gary Walton, dentistry with a personal touch.
His life didn't end with that jump shot. After leading Milan to one of the most historic championships in Indiana State basketball tournament history, he proved he was more than just a timely shooter. He was named Mr. Basketball and went on to become Butler's all-time leading scorer before playing for the country's best amateur team. The impact of that historic jump shot in the 1954 state championship game, however, took on meaning well beyond the basketball court, and it delayed the onslaught of class basketball by several years. But not long enough, in his opinion. I'm Mark Monteith, and once again, I'm going one-on-one with Bobby Plum. Welcome to part two of my interview with Indiana basketball legend Bobby Plum. You might recall we left off last week's episode with a bit of a cliffhanger, as Plum was about to reveal the true meaning of Milan's state championship in 1954. So, to refresh your memory, I replay the setup, reveal the answer, and then continue the conversation with Bobby Plum.
When we went back to Milan, we stayed up here that night, went back Sunday. The team that we had defeated, 43-21, Shelbyville, and held them to two field goals for 51, met us at the outskirts of town, turned on the sirens and took us through all the stoplights. Greensburg did that. We got to Penntown, which is 11 miles outside of Milan. People were walking and cars were parked along the side of the road. We thought it was an accident. There was an 18-mile-long caravan that stretched back to Greensburg behind us, and the state police were in Milan because they brought them in because there wasn't anybody left there. Gene White's mom, who didn't go to the tournament in 53 because they had 450 chickens, she sold the whole damn flock so she could go to the tournament in 1954. There just was nobody there. The state police estimated between 35 and 50,000 people.
That's amazing.
Came to Milan, and you can't get that many in there.
No.
That's the excitement that this thing had created. But the true significance of the 53 and 54, Mark, is this. In the previous 4 years from Milan, I would estimate, and I might be high even, that maybe 16 total students went to college. Now, you don't have to go to college to be a success. All right, we all know that. It opened some doors. What this did for that little community, of the 9 of the 10 of the players that dressed for that tournament went to college. 6 ended up teaching and coaching. And of the 30 in my graduating class, 17 went to college.
I mean, they were inspired by what you had accomplished to go to college?
It was kind of like, the people of Milan had a little spring in their step, and it was like, well, you know, if this happened, why couldn't we do this?
Yeah.
You know, it just
changed their mindset.
There were a lot, there were a lot of us that knew at the end of our junior year on the team that we were going to college, and that just filtered down to the classmates, and it stayed there.
Yeah.
That's the real significance of what happened here.
That's interesting because it tells you about the psychology of small towns and just people in general, and how something great happens and it opens up some doors, you know, just mentally, and people start thinking, well, maybe I can do something too.
Yeah, and I'm not saying this. I don't want that to sound like you have to go to college, and if you don't, there's something wrong, because there certainly isn't. I know a lot of people that I'm the only one in my family that went to college other than my father, and certainly they turned out well. It's just that it does open some doors that wouldn't be there otherwise.
Yeah. Well, one thing about the movie, let's talk about the movie Hoosier some. That certainly kind of took this story around the world. Do you like the movie?
I loved it. They had, now,
my a lot of embellishment in Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. But it, you know, the basic part of it is true. I just told you briefly that Marvin Wood changed our system. He closed practice. He wasn't liked by the fans until he won 5 out of the 6 games. Then they thought he was the greatest coach that ever lived. And all those fans either moved away or died because I can't find him anymore. They called our team, and invited us to a sneak preview before the premiere here. And the Indianapolis Star called me and wanted to write an article. Now, that by itself is pretty significant, me writing an article. I've already told you about my English thing. But they gave me, you all know about this, these little slim notebooks, you know, you can slip in your pocket and think. So I'm there. I'm in a movie. I got my pen out, and I got this notebook, and I'm watching, and I write two sentences. I get out of the movie. That's all that's in that pad are two sentences.
I got so involved in the movie.
You know, the emotions that that movie evokes, good, bad, up, down, cry, laugh, when you leave, you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I ended the article with saying, you know, there's white hats and black hats. If you go to the movie Hoosiers, you're going to like the white hat.
Yeah.
And after it was over, Angelo Pizzo, the writer and co-director, called me aside and he says, Bob, I got two questions, because they didn't know if this was going to sell or not. They knew it'd sell in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't know it was going to be as big as it is. And he said, how'd you like the movie? And I said, Angelo, I loved it. I just thought it was, oh, good. And he said, did we get the last 18 seconds right? We wanted that to be exactly the way it happened. And mm-hmm. it is.
How often, how many times have you seen the movie, you think?
Probably not as many as some others. I tell people I remember what happened, but I've probably seen it 15, 20 times.
Okay. And how many times have you watched the game itself? Because, you know, you can, people can buy a video of the actual game from the IHSAA, and it's also part of a DVD of the movie Hoosiers now. But
yeah, and you can also buy it from the Milan 54 Museum,
okay,
Inc. down
okay,
at
we'll mention that. Okay, you can buy it in Milan. That'd be the place to get it. How many times have you seen that, you think?
Well, I've seen that probably 8 or 10 times. I don't remember the last time that I saw it. We used to show it occasionally at some of our reunions, probably 10 times.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. That's not that many, really. What was life like for the next few weeks after winning this? You talked about the parade and the caravan getting back to Milan and all the people who turned out. What was it like in town for the next few weeks after this?
We didn't have much school.
I was going to say. I mean, that'd be chaos for a while.
Most of the players, and I'll tell you what it was like then. We had... I drove some nice cars. Some of the people in town let me drive their cars, and they let the other players have their car. And we didn't have nice cars. And that was neat. It also coincided with the centennial founding of Milan. It was founded in 1854, so we had a big celebration in July of the centennial and the ball club. It was rather hectic. A lot of things were going on. I traveled with Marvin Wood a lot on his speeches to different athletic events. The townspeople were just ecstatic. I mean, you know, there wasn't any. We couldn't do any wrong. I know we did, but we couldn't. It was a very enjoyable time. Looking back on it, I probably wore myself out. And I don't know if that caused it or not, but I turned down IU, Purdue, and Michigan State to go to Butler because I was going to coach also. And I missed the first 9 games because I had these tremendous headaches. And I remember in the All-Star game that I just didn't have any energy. And I went to Rollo Burkhart was a doctor. And after many, many tests, and I was taking a drug called reticulose, which was a new drug for atomic bomb, the beta or whatever it was. And they determined that I had a slight case of polio. My premasteric reflexes were gone. I had no reflexes here. And they said, that's the first thing polio kills. And I remembered every time I took a step, my head seemed like it was coming off. And again, I never associated that with what went on. But I was awfully tired that summer. And
I think the physical and mental exhaustion of everything.
I have no idea. You know, the polio is caused by that virus, so perhaps I picked that up someplace.
Yeah.
That's the best they could come up with. But I remember I was being shot with penicillin and this reticulose. Why I remember that name, I don't know, and I've never heard of it since. So,
interesting.
So it was a rather hectic summer, busy. You know, colleges had a lot of pressure to go to IU. Most of the people from Milan that went to school, the majority of them went to IU, and I was down there a lot. But it was so new and so overwhelming. I mean, you know, when you have 50 people or so in your town and all of a sudden you're going to all these places, it was just overwhelming.
Yeah. Did ever, you know, it's common for anyone, especially a high school kid who has some huge moment like you did, to kind of have it get to their head a little bit. You know, did you go through a period where maybe...
I don't think so, Mark. As I said, my teammates kept me level, and my older brothers and sisters wouldn't let me do anything.
Yeah.
And I really was a shy, bashful kid. As opposed to getting to my head or getting into trouble, I think it had the opposite effect, because I know Woody and the assistant coach, Clarence Kelly, and Mark Combs, the other assistant. They all talked to me, and as did a lot of fans. They said that, Bob, you've got a lot of notoriety here. There's going to be a lot of young kids look up to you. Be careful what you do.
Yeah. And it sounds like in your case, instead of it causing you to become too confident or cocky or whatever, it just probably lifted you up to become confident.
Yeah, I never had a huge ego of being confident. It was, if anything, the reverse of that, because I was shy and bashful, and they thought I was stuck up at Butler. I didn't go to the campus club because I didn't know how to talk to girls. I had a girlfriend from the time I was a sophomore in high school, but I didn't know how to associate. I didn't know the social things, so I just avoided it.
Plump becomes Mr. Basketball for the annual All-Star Series with Kentucky and hits another game winner when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm talking once again with Bobby Plump. You know, a lot of people remember Plump for hitting the game-winning field goal in Milan's historic state championship game in 1954, but fewer people realize he was Indiana's Mr. Basketball that year, and then went on to a great career at Butler. Here's Plump on Life After Milan.
Well, you mentioned that you were the one of three people to win the Trester Award, a state championship, and Mr. Basketball. Wanted to talk to you about Mr. Basketball somewhat. You guys, at that time, you only played one game against Kentucky.
That at 1954, the only official game was in Indianapolis. They had an unofficial game Kentucky, but it's not on the record. And I didn't go to that because I wasn't feeling well.
Okay.
And my teammate at Butler, who started with me at Butler as a freshman, was an alternate, and he's thanked me ever since because he got to go to Kentucky and do it. But it isn't on the record. Then the next year they had the official two games.
Okay. And you hit the game-winning shot in the All-Star game against Kentucky with 45 seconds to go. You hit your only field goal of the game.
I was going to say, I had a great game there too, didn't I?
Yeah. You were 2 of 10 in the state championship game, and you were 1 of 5 or something like that.
Boy, I graduated just in time. I was going downhill.
But you did hit all 8 of your free throws in that All-Star game. So you hit the game-winning shot against Kentucky to win 75-74 in the Indiana-Kentucky All-Star game. A Kentucky player missed a couple of foul shots later that preserved the win, but that's just like a magical time.
You know who
time.
That player was?
Who?
Yeah, it was a magic time because here I get credit for hitting a game-winning shot and played a lousy game. You know Chris Collinsworth?
Yeah, the football player.
It was his dad.
Really? Interesting. He missed 2 free throws, huh?
Yeah.
They could have won it for the Kentucky All-Stars.
Yeah.
So anyway, you're riding high. Now, you mentioned that you chose Butler over—
I tell people I'd rather be lucky than good. If you're good— I introduced Oscar Robertson one time at a speech because they asked me to speak, and then 3 weeks later they said, instead of speaking, Bob, would you just introduce Oscar? And I said, I'm okay till you can get him. So I introduced him like this. I said, Oscar, you're one of the greatest basketball players I've ever seen, ever played against. I said, you are so good. Every time you step on the court, people expect great things from you. Me, I hit one lucky shot, and they don't expect anything after that. Now come up here and tell them how good you are.
Well, it's not fair, though, to say you were lucky, because you did have scholarship offers from Indiana, Michigan State, and Purdue. You mentioned that you turned down. Why did you choose Butler over those programs?
You know, again, it goes back to my non-confidence probably and introvert. They were so big and so overwhelming, and they seemed to know so much more than I did. And I thought I was going to coach and teach. You notice it's coach and teach, not teach and coach. And and I played for Marvin Wood, and he went to Butler. I knew the Hinkle system, and I thought that it was a great system. I thought I could play in that system as opposed better than a run and gun, perhaps. If Michigan State would have been in Indiana, I might have gone there. Forty Anderson just started at Michigan State, and when I went up there, I figured out later he showed me a film of his offense, and it was a guard-oriented offense. Mm-hmm. Jack Quiggle went up there from South Bend Central and was an All-American. But I thought I was going to teach and coach, and the campus and Mr. Hinkle's low profile and just his name, and Butler was a great school. And the Big Ten had a rule then. It wasn't an NCAA rule, but the Big Ten had a rule that freshmen couldn't play.
Uh-huh.
And freshmen could play at Butler. You know, I wanted to play ball. So those were, I remember the guy at Michigan State said, you know, regardless of that game you had in the All-Star game. And I said, what the hell is he talking about? I didn't know it was so bad. He said, we still want you. But that's why I went to Butler. Mr. Hinkle had a great influence on that. First time let me tell you about a letter I got from him, personally written. Dear Bobby, congratulations on you and your teammates for winning the state tournament. It was a great accomplishment. Paragraph. You're going to have a lot of offers to go to a lot of schools. Just make up your mind to come to Butler University. We have a great university. You get a great education. We travel by all means. He failed to tell me. They only went by airplane once. And paragraph. Please give me a call and let me know when you'd like to come up. Sincerely, Paul D. Tony Hinkle. P.S. If any of your teammates want to come with you, bring them along.
You used this passing
out
scholarship.
There's a recruiting. Now, I brought Ray Kraft and Bob Engel with me. And you knew Mr. Engel. I mean, he was just so up front. We met at the Fidel House. He came back from a baseball game, got his uniform on, lit up a cigarette in this little room, and he's talking to us. And he said, well, now, we don't have scholarships, but Bob, there's a guy that's going to pay your way through. And he said, Ray and Bob, we'll give you a tuition scholarship, but you'll have to pay the rest away. And I'm sitting there thinking, damn, he could have told us individually about that, you know. Yeah. But that's just the way he was.
What stands out in your memory? You finished as Butler's all-time leading scorer, so you had a great career there. But what memories stand out from your college career?
Well, there's a lot of memories. The best memories are playing on Hinkle Fieldhouse floor. It's the best floor I've ever played on, and I've played throughout the world. Oscar Robertson will tell you that. Bobby Leonard will tell you that.
You could jump on
George
that floor,
McGinnis.
A lot of spring there.
You can't. Let me tell you, when the movie Hoosiers came out, they wanted to take People magazine called, and they wanted to take a picture. And I'm standing under the basket on the south end. They set a camera and a tripod on my side of the 10-second line. There was a kid dribbling under the basket on the other end. They had to have him stop because it was jiggling the camera. That's how sensitive that floor is. The experience that playing against teams that I'd heard about forever, and just the manner that Mr. Hinkle handled himself and the opposing teams and officials. He never criticized an official about a call, but he would criticize them if they missed the rule. He had a demeanor about him that exuded confidence without being overconfident.
Uh-huh.
When I graduated from Butler and started playing at Phillips, I found out that I had more fundamental knowledge of basketball than anybody there. Now, that's the internal memories. The greatest memory, and you'd have to know Mr. Hinkle to know this, we were the first team at Butler to go to the NIT. And unfortunately, we played St. John the first game, and they beat us 9 points, and they won the tournament. But after it's over, we're in the hotel room, and Bob Dietz is assistant coach, and Mr. Hinkle congratulates, great time and things. And he said, now, fellas, I want you to have a good time when you're here in New York. As you go out the door, Mr. Dietz will give you some money, and go out and have a good time. He gave us $5.
Listen up.
He didn't want us to have too good a time. I told that at a roast for him, and Bob Dietz got up and said, "We played Long Island University in New York in 1941. They gave us $2. Everybody said Mr. Hickel had fish hooks in his pocket.
Bob Dietz told me the story once that when he was an assistant coach, Tony wanted him to go down to Louisville and recruit Wes Unseld, or somewhere in Kentucky, wherever he played. And he said, "Here, take this baseball bat and give it to him." You know, that's what their inducement to Wes Unseld. They want to give him a baseball bat.
I visited Wes Unseld he was our pediatrician, and he was a doctor at Butler. He and I went to a Louisville game, visited Wes in his house, and he and his mom came. He almost came to Butler, by the way.
Uh-huh.
He and his mom came up to Butler, and then Mr. Hinkle, had me take. We had Wes Unseld and Gary Cox and Gene Milner. When they take him to the 500-mile race, and he said, "Now I want you to show these guys a good time." He gave me $20. It was Bob Parr was the doctor. He drove down, and I saw Wes play in high school. Here's a 6'8 guy, and he's bringing the ball down the court, dribbling behind his back, and I said, "Holy mackerel!"
Mm-hmm.
It was a very broadening experience, and it was probably one of the reasons that I am like I am, and I finally found out that people are just people, no matter where they grew up, how much money they got, or where they have money or not. We all want the same things.
Yeah.
And that was a long, long learning experience, but that was the start of it. And I am not sure I would have gotten that at the other universities.
Yeah.
Not that they're bad universities. I just think that surroundings there help with that. And then when I went to Phillips, Bud Browning was a coach, and he was the same type of worldwide guy. He coached a 48 Olympic team, and we went to the Middle East for 7 weeks on a good tour. We went to Mexico for 4 weeks for the State Department on both of them. And those broadening things and seeing people in different countries, different surroundings, it finally dawned on me that people are just people.
Yeah.
Just be yourself.
Plump's basketball career continues, and then he settles into the real world when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, Mark Monteith here with Hoosier basketball legend Bobby Plump. One of the more impressive things about the Milan story is how the players handled their notoriety and went on to successful lives without trying to cling to the past. Now Plump discusses what became of his teammates and coach, Marvin Wood.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, you went on to play for the Phillips Oilers out when you left Butler, a top AAU team, amateur team. Did you have any opportunity to try out for an NBA team? Or
could have gone with the Minneapolis Lakers, but I wasn't a high draft choice. And your fans, again, will have to understand that it isn't like it is today. An East-West All-Star game, Archie Deese was there. He was the number one draft choice in the NBA, leading scorer in the Big Ten, All-American 3 years in the Big Ten. His offer was $8,000 for the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
I would have made maybe $4,500. I signed for $7,200 at Phillips. I had a job, whether I made the team or not, because they use it as a recruiting tool. K.S. Boots Adams started a team in 1919, became CEO in 1942. Every CEO at Phillips through 2001 was an ex-basketball player. His son is Bud Adams, that owns the Tennessee Titans.
Ah.
And they used it in the 20s and 30s to bring people in, and 40s. And I didn't know all this. I didn't even know there was a Phillips 66 team. And the only reason I got there was Mr. Hinkle. This is how he's respected. If we got time, I'll give you two stories on Mr. Hinkle.
Yeah, please.
he called me in and said I was elected to go to the East-West All-Star Game at Madison Square Garden. And at that same time, they have the National AAU Tournament in Denver, and Marion Kay had wanted me to play with them and go to the National Tournament. And I said, well, Mr. Hinkle, I'd like to go, but I don't know which one. He said, well, do you want to play after you? I said, sure. I said, I want to play. He said, well, I'd suggest you go to the East-West All-Star Game. I'm up there, and Archie Dees, I had received information from Abe Saperstein, with the Globetrotters before that, play 18 games, college all-stars in the Globetrotters. You got $100 a game, $1,800. My dad made $3,200 all year. Mm-hmm. And I called Mr. Hinkle, and I said, I can make $1,800. And he said, Bob, if you take it, you're a professional. And he said, I have an appointment for you in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, to interview with Phillip 66 to play basketball. I didn't know they had a team, and so I turned it down. Archie turned it down because it would have made him a professional. McCracken said, you don't have any bargaining power. He signed with Denver in our league and got $12,000 finally. But I go to Bartlesville, Oklahoma. There's Bud Browning and the assistant coach, Gib Ford. I'm the only guy there. They got a gymnasium in their office building. I go up and shoot for 10 minutes, and Browning says, take a shower. Well, I'm in that shower. All I could see was $1,800 flying out that window, man. I thought, oh, man. I walk out of the shower, walk into Bud's office, and said, we'd like to offer you a position, and here's a salary. And I said, okay, fine. Where do I sign? Well, I became his assistant coach, and when we were in the Middle East, I asked him, I said, I don't understand this. I said, you had never seen me play. You never saw a film. And I shoot for 10 minutes. You send me to shower and hire me when it's over. And he said, Bob, while you were in the shower, I called Lou Wilkie, who served on the rules committee with Mr. Hinkle. He said, I told him his plump kid, he said he's pretty quick and he can shoot, but he's awful small. And Lou Wilkie said, if Mr. Hinkle said he could play, hire him.
There you go. The recommendation alone.
I met John Wooden for the first time, except when we played him, but I don't remember meeting him then. When Kentucky won the NCAA tournament, he had the beta shoe at that time for high school basketball players. This is 78, 79, something like that. They were showing their wares before the tournament, and my wife was with me, and I'm off someplace, and she's looking at this beta shoe, going to buy it for Jonathan, our son, and things. And she's asking these questions. This guy's answering them. She's not looking at who it is. And finally, she looks and says, oh, you're him. You're him. Don't move. I'm scared him to death. You know, it's Mr. Wooden. So she said, I'm going to go get my husband. I come back. I stuck out my hand. I said, Mr. Wooden, I'm Bobby Plump. Before he shook my hand, the first words out of his mouth, he said, you played for the great one.
Ah, yes. He had great respect for Mr. Hinkle.
Yeah.
Yeah, he almost went there himself.
Yeah. That's how Mr. Hinkle was respected.
Yeah. 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 Wooden told me that he very nearly went to Butler, but Purdue had the engineering program that he was interested in, and that's why he went there.
Yeah.
As you said, you have stayed in close contact with your former teammates. It appears like I don't see any negatives that came out of this. Sometimes when there's a great experience, some kind of negatives develop. There's either jealousy or somebody doesn't handle their fame the right way. I don't see any of that happening with you guys.
I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's ever been the case. As I said, we have had a reunion every year since 55. A couple of the one of our players ended up being an actor in Hollywood, Bill Jordan. He's been out there since 64. And when they were filming the movie Hoosiers, Gene Hackman, I went in to down to talk to him, and I said, I haven't met you. My name's Buddy. He said, get over here. This is what this movie's all about. He said, I know one of your buddies, Bill Jordan, out in Hollywood, and we told a few stories. But he doesn't get back very often, and a couple of the players don't come. Generally, there's seven of us. One of us is deceased, mm-hmm. And only one. And then I have not detected that. Ray Kraft and Roger Schroeder and Rollin Cutter and Gene White and I don't think there's any jealousy there, mm-hmm. Mark. I really don't.
Yeah, there's no hint of it.
It's been a remarkable run by a bunch of kids that didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Well, you know, small town kids, and you've all done well. Yeah. At the same time, I don't sense that you guys have been like living in the past. You've all kind of gone on with your lives and done your thing, and you're not trying to live off of this one championship.
You know, people have asked me that question a lot. How significant was that? And I said, well, for an instantaneous thrill, I've never had anything like it. But for a lasting effect, there's been a lot of things that happened in my life that had a lot more influence personally, mm-hmm. inside than that. And I think that's the way the other guys feel. For instance, And this doesn't necessarily mean, maybe it means that we're just stubborn, but this year, I believe it's this year, there will be four of us that are celebrating 50th anniversary of marriage plus. This will be my, Gene White's 54 years, mine's 53, 52 coming up. Rollins was 50th last year. I think Ray's is 50 this year. And there may be I think Roger's in that area. So, and four of them married classmates.
Wow.
That's remarkable.
That is. We all have a lot in common, obviously. Now, how much longer did Coach Wood stay at Milan after this championship?
He left that year.
That year.
I told you, I went to, he asked me to go to speeches with him and things, and we were in Newcastle, and I'm just a kid enjoying myself, and all of a sudden, after the speech is over, we're up in his office, and this guy's talking to him, and I'm reading a magazine, doing something, and all of a sudden, I hear, well, Mr. Wood, when you come here next year, and I'm going, when you what? I remember thinking right then, I said, why would he leave Milan? He just got a new washer and dryer for free. They put in his house. I thought, man, he's got a,
want,
he got a maid. Yeah, what do you want? And he told me on the way back, he said, Bob, I am thinking about leaving, and Newcastle is one of the places. And he said, I like Milan, but I think it's there's a good chance for me to advance here. And I washer and dryer, and you're still going to leave. So he went to Newcastle. They promised to build Chrysler Arena, and they didn't start on it for 2 years. And he left Newcastle then and was the first coach at North Central High School when it opened in 1956. He spent 9 years there, and then when I moved back here, I lived next door to him for 2 years. He went to Mishawaka for 2 years. He was at Shelbyville as athletic director for 4 years, I think it was, while his kids were in school. They asked him to come back to Mishawaka to be the coach, and he started coaching the boys back there, and then he ended up coaching St. Mary's girls team the rest of his life.
Plunt takes on multi-class basketball when one-on-one continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, talking this week again with one of Indiana's ultimate basketball legends, Bobby Plunt. It's not surprising that one of the players from the Milan team that won the state championship in 1954 would be against the change to multi-class basketball. So let's let Plunt make his argument.
Well, we mentioned earlier that Milan's championship in 1954 kind of delayed the oncoming of class basketball. You don't find anybody who, you know, of our age or, you know, baby boomers or people who grew up during the single class tournament who is in favor of multi-class basketball. It's really got to eat at you. I mean, to see multi-class
basketball. Well, it did initially, but it, you know, I've accepted it. I don't like it. I still prefer the single class system. And I want to correct you when you said, well, we talk about class basketball. We had class basketball. Now we have multi-class.
Right.
And
right.
And saying that, Mark, I want this to be perfectly clear. That takes nothing away from the accomplishment that these student athletes have today in the multi-class system. Mm-hmm. It's still a great accomplishment, and I'm proud of everything that they do. I just think it's a disservice to the student athletes to have a multi-class as opposed to a single class. I've had a couple of players from two different schools come up to me and tell me they'd rather won a sectional in the single class and win the state tournament because it was anticlimactic.
Yeah.
They were in 1A and 2A. And it has become, it seems to me like, and I ask all the people that come into Plump's Last Shot that are fans, I ask them who won the state tournament last year. And they said, which class? And I said, I don't care. Which class? I said, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's almost become a regional championship as opposed to a state championship. Those that are in the area know that they're state champions. A lot of people throughout the state don't. And again, I'm not saying this to take away from their accomplishment. I've been accused of that and said, oh, you want to protect your reputation. You don't want another school. I said, that has nothing to do with it. We had the best state tournament in the nation. Everybody knew it. During the process, I had visitors or telephone calls from every major newspaper in the United States, the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Philadelphia Inquirer, Chicago Tribune, Houston, Dallas. Peter Van Zandt from the Dan Rather Show brought his own TV crew down to Plump's Last Shot. I went over to meet him as he stepped across the threshold, and his words, and I'll clean it up a little, I shook his hand, and he said, Bob, what is wrong with the IHSA? You got the best damn state tournament in the nation. Why do they want to change it? Yeah. This is a national newsman that understood what we had. And not because I'm from Milan, but because any small school in a single-class tournament, if you won a sectional, the whole state knew about it. And if you went to the semi-state as a small school, you would know about it.
Mm-hmm.
How many times has Milan been in a semi-state in a multi-class tournament, Mark?
Yeah, I have no idea.
They've been in a semi-state twice, and nobody around this state knows it.
Right.
That's the point that I'm making, especially if it was Milan because of all this history and stuff. I've only found one person that I've asked that question. They said, oh, I think they've been defeated in the section every year. Only one person answered it, and he was a sports writer that was at both games. That's the point.
Yeah.
That I think it just takes away. And the disservice that I mentioned, I've had coaches tell me that prior to the multi-class, when the college recruiters would come around, they'd ask one question. I don't care what size the school was. Can your kid play at my level? You know what their question is today?
What?
What class do they play in? Now, there are exceptions that, and you'll see some from the smaller schools, but the overall general recruiting process, they want to know what class they're playing in.
Yeah.
It isn't. Can you, because now there's no advantage of playing above your class. And a lot of the of schools above the class, you don't get an opportunity to see them against what they think are better. And I just think it's wrong to say you can't play at this level.
Yeah,
that doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, well, the sports.
Now, I know it makes more champions, but as Bob Collins said back when he was live and writing for the Star, he said, "Why don't we have 20?"
Well, exactly. Why four? I could almost understand two to avoid the huge mismatches because some schools are so big now.
It still would have some. That would be a lot better than four.
Yeah.
No question.
And I think people who have been around a while understand how big just winning a sectional used to be. You know, I was telling you earlier that I played on Pike's team in 1972 when it won its first sectional championship in school history. We got out of school Monday. You know,
sure.
That's how big a deal it was.
Yeah, John Wooden was one of the first gentleman that joined our crusade. We had about an 18-month thing before the multi-class tournament. We had a thing for people to sign. I should have brought that with me, but I'll paraphrase it. He put his full name, phone number, address, Martinsville High School, Purdue University, had the whole thing down there, and then he said something to the effect that more doesn't make it better. And I believe that the IHSAA tournament is the equivalent of the NCAA tournament, and I don't believe changing to a class system will improve it. After all, and being an English teacher, he quoted Stevenson and Cervantes, what those gentlemen said is that the journey is more important than the arrival.
Yeah.
He said the tournament was never made on winning the state tournament. It was the opportunity to win the state tournament.
Yeah.
I used that quote, and you know what some of the proponents said.
What?
And this is back in 96, 97. Well, Mr. Wooden was a great coach, and he's a great man, but he needs to get in the modern era. He's a little old.
No, oh, boy.
No, that's true.
Well, I believe it. But, yeah, he told me, I had him as a guest on my show, and he told me that winning a state championship as a player, as he did in 1927, was a bigger thrill than coaching all those NCAA championship teams.
He said, he also said that he would give up two or three of his NCAA championship to have a state championship team that he coached in Indiana.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
I just think they got the emphasis in the wrong place. They got the emphasis of winning as the ultimate goal. And I mentioned I was at Lincoln, Nebraska, and I spoke at a state championship banquet. I asked the coach before we started, I said, how many classes do you have? And he said, eight.
Eight?
That's what I said. And he said,
never heard of that.
Yeah. I said, well, how many is in each class? He said, 35. He said, they want to change it to 25 so we can have more. You know how many people were at that state banquet?
How many?
38.
There you go.
Two players didn't show. True.
Yeah, I believe it. I mean, yeah, it's no big deal to win something that's easy to win. You know, that's not a big deal. How many schools were in the tournament when you won it? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, there were 751, but there were a lot, you know, a lot of small schools then.
Yeah.
And there's 400 and maybe one or two now. So say you got 100 in each. That's better than 35. And it's still, and again, it's still an accomplishment. But it doesn't create the excitement playing against your same size school that you always had. Just beating a favorite in the sectional would make headlines before.
Yeah. Well, to me, it's like the NCAA tournament. Almost, you don't have that many big upsets, but occasionally a 15 seed beats a number 2 seed, and occasionally a George Mason gets to the Final Four. And just the possibility of that makes the tournament exciting.
The possibility.
Yeah. Do you see any possibility of the state tournament going back to
I wish class? I could give you a positive answer on that. I can't. I think the mindset of the principals that control the IHSAA, I had one principal tell me, well, we've got to go to a multi-class because the football is a multi-class, and those players are making fun of our players because they can't win a state tournament. I'm serious. And I said, well, in football, forget the size, you almost have to have multi-class because you can only play one game a week. You wouldn't have a season.
Yeah.
And it's different. You've got a history from 75. We got a history from 1911.
Right.
The principals really see this. It was voted down 14 to nothing in 1979. Oh. But all but one of the board of directors was an ex-basketball coach. The coaches, after the two-year experiment, voted 83% to go back to single class. They ignored that.
They ignored it.
The principals want champion behind their name. They can hang out signs and do that. And you get enough signs. My son had more trophies by the time he was finished with the eighth grade, and I got my lifetime. Everybody got a trophy.
Yeah.
You know where those trophies are? It doesn't mean anything.
Right. Yeah, they're meaningless if they're given to you.
I don't think they'll go back. They had a pretty good war chest built up by television money.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, they're having to get into that. They don't give money back to the schools now. They used to give money back to the schools. And they're feeling some of the pinch. They're getting into their endowment because of the cost of what's happening. And people just aren't excited about it.
One-on-One returns in a moment. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith. Hope you enjoyed the second hour of my conversation with Bobby Plump this week. You know, hitting that game-winning jump shot in 1954 earned him a lot of invitations to banquets and celebrity golf tournaments over the years. In fact, I first met him at a golf outing in Marion more than 30 years ago. But as you can tell from the preceding interviews, his heroic deed didn't go to his head. Just as impressively, he and his Milan teammates haven't tried to live in the past either. But you couldn't blame them if they tried, could you? Now, don't forget, you can hear this and other episodes of One-on-One on our website at 1070thefan.com. Just click on the One-on-One window at the bottom of the homepage, and you'll have access to all the episodes of this series via podcast. And I'll be back next week with yet another spine-tingling episode right here on 1070 The Fan.